Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Good evening and welcome to The Big Picture. Thank you for joining us on this lovely, fairly warm Wednesday afternoon. Thank you for our panel for joining us today. We've got a range of topics to talk about, as ever, on URN's only politics and current affairs show. We'll first be discussing the deal between the US and the Taliban for releasing a prisoner of war from America in exchange for the release of some top senior Taliban fighters and figures from Guantanamo Bay. We'll also be discussing the ongoing row between Britain and the European Commission on the presidency of the European Commission. And we'll also be discussing privatisation and how it's affected the public sector in the past, the proposals now, and how it will affect it in the future. If you'd like to discuss any of the issues we'll be talking about this evening, you can text in on 07762 212434 or send us a free web text via the website. So thank you for our panel for joining us. Let's introduce them. So we have...
Hi, it's Joe Himsworth here, a first-year history student.
Seb Bench, second-year politics student.
Hi, I'm David. I'm a PhD student reading criminal justice.
And I'm Luke, a second-year law with American law student.
Thank you all for joining us. I'm Matt. I'm your host for this evening. It's my last ever show, actually, this time. So I'm actually quite sad.
Aww.
So lots of sympathy, of course. No sympathy on this show, typically. Right, we'll kick off the show with the story about Guantanamo prisoners being released in exchange for the return of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. He's been released after 5 years in captivity with the Afghan Taliban in a controversial exchange for five Taliban officials being held at Guantanamo Bay. The prisoner swap came after secret talks between the US government and the Taliban were brokered by Qatar. And it's caused quite a controversy. It's, you know, should these prisoners be released? It's kicked up quite a storm. So I'd like to ask the panel that. Should these prisoners have been released as part of the deal? David.
Well, the answer is yes, whether as part of the deal or just in general. I mean, Obama campaigned originally on the pledge to close down Guantanamo, and you have to read these releases as part of that general process. I mean, the problem for the incoming Obama regime was never that they didn't have the political willpower to close down Guantanamo. It was that they didn't have the political capital to make other states take their citizens back. None of the Saudi citizens were wanted back in Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone who'd be rendered through Egypt and all of that could have been a lot of embarrassing European human rights claims if certain people had returned back to Guantanamo. And, you know, watch this space. I mean, just look at the complaints of Moaz and Beg and people like that. But leaving aside the expediency and the fact that, you know, Obama promised to shut it down, I do think this was the right decision to make in this particular circumstance. I think we're reaching the point now where it's becoming especially worthwhile to try and engage the Taliban and engage with the sorts of people who are traditionally thought of as terrorists in an attempt to bring some sort of stability to the Middle East and to recognize, you know, that our time in the Middle East is over and we need to provide as much stability there in the region as possible. And any sort of brokering of deals between them that doesn't create a fresh pressure towards conflict, I think, is good in that respect.
Just to reiterate the story from that point, David, the US had been pushing for these for this deal for 3 years now, and the reason it hadn't moved forward was because it had been pushing for a wider peace process, while the Taliban wanted to limit the talks to a prisoner swap. Seb, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd agree with David on many points. I think there are kind of several aspects to this. Firstly, of course, Guantanamo Bay kind of on its own, I'd agree with David saying it's not really a shame. I feel anyone leaving that, and it any step closer to that shutting down is beneficial. In regards to really whether it's kind of a worthwhile swap, I think presumably it must be. Obviously, I don't know, as any of us do, the precise details of the individual released and all the four Taliban prisoners returned, so it's possible for us to make kind of judgment of almost combative efficiency and use. But certainly, as said, David says, as we get closer to withdrawal in Afghanistan is impending, we do need to increase stability. And clearly, there are going to be many kind of Taliban figures left in Afghanistan and places like that. So their return won't have a great impact on that situation in terms of destabilizing it. The improving relationship may help stabilize it. And I'm sure all those who know the returned American soldier, it's obviously a great for them and him having been in captivity for so long.
Luke.
I think some of David's comments at the start, they almost came from an assumption, I suppose, that we are talking about two parties here who are in a dispute, as it were, that we're both looking for peace and that we're both striving for peace. And that's kind of the traditional idea of it. You know, even if you look over at the conflict in Israel-Palestine that's going on there, you've got two parties with different ideas of what constitutes peace. But the idea is that they are both trying to go for that. I think with the Taliban in particular, with the Al-Qaeda, I am going to draw the distinction there. I still think for both of those, actually striving for peace is not what they want. They are striving for a sense of control in their area. They're not striving for... They may be looking again for almost what they see in a warped sense as being peace. But it in no sense is it. You know, it is still the disorder, although it's disorder that's controlled by them within that area. And I think that makes it difficult with these sorts of deals and working towards a kind of a peace process, because it just doesn't conform to the traditional ideas of two parties with a different idea of what is peace trying to work.
So the deal as it stands, do you support it as it stood?
Well, I'll be honest, again, much like Seb said there, obviously the details are a bit murky of it. And I know in particular, actually, one of the interesting aspects of it is that the American soldier has now come back to be investigated by his own military. You know, the US Army are conducting their own investigations into allegations of desertion. And there are obviously lots of different ideas about what's gone on there. So I wouldn't comment on the actual deal itself. Obviously, it is worse that there are people who were allegedly or who were part of the Taliban who are back in Taliban hands. It is better that an American is back in American hands. But obviously there was a bit of a give and take there.
David.
I do have to I have to concede a lot of that, to be fair. I think Luke is right that the Taliban as a unified body doesn't want the same sort of peace, the same sort of resolution as the US and as the West in general wants in the Afghanistan situation. But I think you have to take the broader term here, firstly because of the political situation in Afghanistan and the particularly tenuous nature of any sort of centralized political authority within that country, especially in the wake of the 2001 invasion and the deposition of the Taliban. The Taliban could easily get a lot of support from the autonomous tribal leadership groups and with promises of the sort of relative freedom that they had during the Taliban regime's reign. And there's a lot of danger there that if there isn't some sort of compromise, if there isn't some sort of consensus reached, then we could just see exactly what happened when they withdrew from Vietnam, that, you know, the North just comes crashing back down again. Having said that as well, I also think you need to recognize that the Taliban as an insurgency group, it is very different from Al-Qaeda, and Luke's right to make that distinction. I think it's fair to make that distinction. But the Taliban is not necessarily an entirely unified body, particularly after the last going on for 15 years of effectively total war, at least on their terms. So I think from their perspective, there may be many people who would recognize and would accept, at least in the short term, a more conciliatory approach, would be willing to get involved there. And weakening that legitimacy base in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, would help overall to restore some semblance of order to people living their everyday lives in the region.
I just kind of add on to what David said in the distinction between terrorism, between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Taliban, as I suppose it's still fair to call them terrorists, are not the international terrorists of Al-Qaeda. So we can't say assume that these Taliban people pose a great threat to the US or the UK or anything like that. It's far more their impact will be felt in Afghanistan, and therefore clearly it's still a destabilized situation with bombings and domestic terrorism in Afghanistan. So it's unlikely that'll increase, and there is the because of these four people being released. And you hope perhaps if it does have some impact in helping with stability in a greater sense in Afghanistan when the West pulls out, but it's hard to tell.
I mean, some of the criticism that's been levelled at the US government for this is that it might provide an incentive to America's adversaries to conduct further kidnappings of US personnel. Do you think that will be the case with this deal? David.
I think there is a risk of that, and people should be aware of that. But at the same time, you have to recognize that the sorts of bodies that are going to kidnap U.S. personnel were probably going to kidnap U.S. personnel anyway. There's a big difference between the U.S. having something having some people that it definitely wants to get back from the Taliban, in this case Sergeant Bergdahl, and that the Taliban wants to get back from it, and another insurgency group, let's say for the sake of the argument, I don't know, Boko Haram, coming in and trying to get them to effect major socio-political change, either in Nigeria or, you know, in the US's approach to African politics. In that regard, I don't think that's going to have the same effect. And I think it's very historically and it's very politically situated, and it's a very unique set of circumstances.
Yeah, I think that is an important thing to make, an important point to make there, in terms of who the Taliban are looking to get back from America and who America would look to get back. America would obviously look to get any troop that it's got over there, any individual, any American citizen back into American arms, because that's just the nature of America and the nature of, I suppose you could say, a Western government, a civilized government. The Taliban, on the other hand, I thought that would cause some controversy, but I'd say America's still at least a civilized government. On the other hand, the Taliban, obviously a lot of them fighters, are the fighters that are fighting for Islamic fundamentalism as their motive. They have sort of given over their life anyway. And the idea that actually the Taliban would sacrifice the advantage that they could get through, for example, creating some horrendous videos of dragging American soldiers' heads through villages and doing that sort of thing, and some of those really horrendous images that the Taliban do like to use, and they like to use as a propaganda tool, I think actually, as exactly what David said, really, the difference, that there's no greater incentive on them to kidnap or to do these horrendous things now than there has been in the past, because it's always been there.
Joe?
I mean, I for the most part, agree with David, to be honest. That sort of key point, which is that, you know, these sort of Islamist insurgencies, if you can call them that, do this sort of thing anyway. And, of course, the sort of key to your question was that weren't this set a precedent? I think if it's continued any longer in different circumstances, then perhaps yes. But under this circumstance, I think it's unlikely.
David, would you like to respond quickly?
Well, I just wanted to add as well that, again, on top of that pragmatic element, that this is a very unique set of circumstances, I think there's also an aspirational element of, you know, my support for this deal, which is that from my perspective and in my opinion, most of the problems that are associated with international terrorism are the problems that can be solved in much the same way as the problems of international counterterrorism in the days of the global war on terror. If there's more conciliation, more recognition, more support, more help, there's less of the sort of deprivation, there's less of the sort of us versus them mentality in the states that see themselves as suffering under the West's thumb. And in the long term, that can only help to reduce the sort of thing that the quote-unquote Islamist extremists prey off of in recruiting people onto their cause. It's not the only thing that's going to help by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think it represents a good sea change in US politics.
Seb?
Yeah, I don't think this will have a great impact in encouraging more kidnappings of US personnel. I mean, we can't, as Dave said, discount the risk entirely, but I would agree with the panel when say first the people who have got the capacity to kidnap American personnel and would want to in this situation are going to anyway, and maybe the difference would be that if they think they can get something else, they may keep them alive instead of killing them. But I don't think, as said it's very specific, this case, in terms of what you want, and it's not the same as US blanketing giving to, say, criminal groups who fundraise by hostages through that. We have to be careful, as the rest of the panel have been, in saying that this is going to open the floodgates to massive increase in kidnappings.
I mean, one of the measures of the deal was that Qatar was an intermediary body in the negotiations with the Taliban, between the Taliban and the US. Under the deal, the five free Taliban detainees will be banned from leaving Qatar for at least a year. Now, the US has consistently argued that it does not negotiate with terrorists. Does the involvement of Qatar as an intermediary prove that it has or it hasn't, David?
It definitely helps. And again, I think this could only have happened at a very specific point in the American political cycle. We're coming to the end of Obama's second term. He's got nothing to win by gaining another election. So he can afford to invest in his principles when it comes to international relations and not simply fall back on the fact that he needs to get reelected by an America which is very, very wary of doing anything with those Muslimic ray gun toting people. You know, that's being very flippant, but in all fairness, you know, Obama's second election was buoyed up by the fact of his you know, of the targeted assassination of Osama bin Laden, which was a massively important factor in the huge spike in public opinion he got. So I think this is going to be a deal that's very unpopular in the US.
It was also one of probably about five good things that Obama's done in his past few years in office, in all the time he's been there.
Oh, why
well,
not?
Well, you know, define
I mean,
those.
Come on, Luke. What are the five good things that he's done whilst he's been in office?
An extremely good question. At the top there is the assassination of Osama bin Laden.
Okay, right. Seth, would you like to say something?
Yes. Try and, I suppose, narrow it back down to the issue rather than President Obama's legacy as a whole. I'm sure we could expand the whole show on that if we wanted to.
We could, easily.
Gringenna, technically, I think the statement, you know, the US and the West does not agree with terrorists is a great statement, is broadly true in most times, but I think in secret, as these were in times, I think nations do negotiate with terrorists. And at a time where we're no longer in the global war on terror, and the whole talk isn't that these are the enemy, we're the good guys, and it's a clash of civilizations and cultures to the end. We can afford to be more nuanced, which this event is. And ultimately, if going with terrorists who have said aren't international terrorists, but will activities are focused, well, in Afghanistan is the previous activity, but will, as you said, be held in Qatar, then actually it makes sense to we'll go beyond just the statement of not negotiating with terrorists and actually try and debate, as we have been doing, whether it's actually worth it.
Yeah, in terms of the Osama assassination, I think, yeah, we could debate that back and forth, and I'm going to resist the urge to rise to Luke's bait there, you know. You know, success of the Obama regime or war crime, you decide, basically. Having said that, I think it's also important to remember that this soundbite that America does not negotiate with terrorists, which was always a hang-on from the bad old days of the Bush regime, but which, again, is a big crowd-pleaser in quote-unquote middle America, is palpably untrue when you consider the breadth of the definition of a terrorist. I mean, the initial terrorists, of course, were the French government in the post-revolutionary terror. And in that regard, you know, we have to recognize that states can create, can perform terrorism. We have to remember that insurgent groups aren't necessarily of the nature of Al-Qaeda and of the Taliban, and that the Taliban may not be terrorist in every action that they do. In that regard, America negotiates with terrorists all the time, and I think, quite frankly, it's a good time to drop this ridiculous notion and just get on with it.
Luke. Absolutely. I mean, I think the idea of not negotiating with terrorism is trying to de-incentivize and try to show that the government would be strong in dealing with what you do see as traditional terrorists, i.e. standalone terrorist incidents. But in something like this, if you do take such a fundamental approach to it and say that you're going to apply the same standards you would, for example, apply to people who had just done a spontaneous single terrorist attack that were looking to, for example, negotiate in order to get money or something like that, then there's no point to do that. There's clearly different circumstances.
Just a reminder, if you'd like to text in on any of the issues we'll be discussing, the number to do so is 07762-212434, or you can send us a free web text. Right, we're going to have to leave it there for now. We'll be back in a second. We'll be talking about the row over the European Commission presidency, particularly between Britain and the EC. Welcome back to The Big Picture. That was Janice Joplin with Peace on My Heart. Next, we'll be discussing the EC presidency, the presidency of the European Commission. A row has brewed between Angela Merkel and the UK, mainly, over German Chancellor Angela Merkel's preference to have former Luxembourg Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker as the next EU Commission President. Some European leaders have voiced opposition to the move, including Hungary and Sweden, as well as the UK. Correspondents say the UK government see Mr. Juncker as too much of an EU federalist, and it pointed to the need for a quote-unquote lengthy process to find consensus. Downing Street has sought to emphasise that national governments and not the European Parliament will have to agree on the next president. But Mr. Juncker is seen by David Cameron and Downing Street as having been effectively too institutionalised and not enough of a reformist, which is what they want. So my question to the panel, are Cameron's concerns justified, or is it just rhetoric to make him appear tougher on the EU?
Well, Luke. I mean, to put this into perspective, this is, amongst the public, an absolute non-issue in terms of, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be significant, but I am saying that it isn't significant. And I mean, there was a poll recently they did that found 8.2% of EU voters across the whole EU could name Juncker as the Commission presidency candidate. I reckon that figure would be lower in the United Kingdom, quite significantly actually. I would be surprised if it was 2-3% of people that knew who he was, let alone what he stood for, who his history was. And I think that shows a real disattachment from the electorate, clearly across the whole EU, but particularly in the UK, with any of these candidates, when in reality, when EU reform is such a massive thing on the agenda at the minute, or it's certainly perceived to be a massive thing on the agenda for people, it is something that they should be taking an interest in. But as the public goes, I think, you know, Cameron's effectively just doing this on his own. This is a very internal political governmental matter. And as far as looking for public consensus goes, no one really knows anything about it in order to offer their own opinion.
But regardless of what the public thinks, do you think that it's justifiable concern that he's not enough of a reformist figure?
Well, I'll be honest, I'd probably sit there with the rest of the 98% of the UK public, and I don't really know that much about him, so I'm not in a position to comment on him personally. Personally, I do feel that the EU needs reform, and therefore, if he's not somebody who's looking to reform it and wants to carry it on as it is, then I wouldn't support him. But yeah, you know, I sit in the camp of people that really doesn't know that much about him.
Okay, David.
It's an interesting question. I mean, to come back on some of Luke's point there, once again, he's absolutely right about the not even apathy but ignorance of the majority of the European Union public about who Juncker is and what he stands for. But having said that, I think it is the sort of issue that's going to gain a lot of attention, particularly in the wake of the success of the Rechtspopulist parties across the European Union, the right-wing populists, such as the party with a U whose name must not be mentioned. Having said that, I think the fact that Cameron's kind of throwing his toys out of the pram a little bit with the European Union and saying, no, we're going to move our referendum forward to 2016 rather than 2017 if you don't agree to let us have a more reformist figure in the EC presidency. I think it's also important to mention, remember that this is only, what, the second or the third presidency that the Commission has had. I mean, Van Rompuy was the first, wasn't he? So it's a testament, perhaps, to the relative obscurity of the post-Lisbon regime as much as it is to anything else. And I think this controversy can only serve to bring the position of the presidency and the position of the Commission within the within the Union as a whole a lot closer into the shade. To actually answer the question, no, I don't think it's a valid concern. I think federalism is great, and even if it wasn't, Juncker is going to be massively under the thumb of the member states who send their delegates to the Commission, many of whom, in the wake of the European elections, will be saying, well, let's hang on, maybe let's not go with the sort of José Manuel Barroso optimism about federalism, and let's dial it back a bit. And if we are going to go for it, let's play it more in the long term and recognise the complaints of the Eurosceptics.
Just to give some background information on Juncker himself, he's been in the EU for years now. He supported its social justice agenda. He's chaired Eurogroup of finance ministers during the financial crisis. He backs EU integration, played a big role in the launch of the euro, defends EU subsidies for farmers, and wants the EU to reach a free trade deal with the US. So, Seb, your point.
Well, firstly, as Luke has said, it is a perennial problem when talking about the EU, is the public, you said, apathy and ignorance, both around sometimes its figures, but often its processes and the way it works. However, as David has said, I think the issue it suggests in around the EU is actually far more, well, important, certainly known about and cared about by the British people. And so, even if people don't really know Juncker, then I think the issues about EU reform and where it goes are certainly cared about by a great number of people. I think on the one hand, it's a slightly difficult issue for Cameron, partly because obviously he's always seems to be facing the problem on Europe about his backbenchers, the more Eurosceptic elements, and certainly even just before this happened, directly after the European elections, a couple of people in the party were saying they should push the referendum forward to 2016, which I don't think really makes much difference, really, from having a one in 2017. But so he's got to try and balance that. He's trying to balance that out. But I think there is the problem which, prior to the European election, it was suggested, even if it's not the precise way it would pick, that it would be, you know, whichever group wins the most in the parliament, you know, will have their figure as the European Commission president. It was strongly implied and suggested that it would be like that. And now, obviously, since, you know, David Cameron doesn't like the party person who would do that, then AFP and several other leaders say, actually, no, it should be the nation states that decide it, and we want one we like. And there is certainly a disconnect between what the national governments want here and what the people tacitly voted for as the commission president by voting for their group.
Joe.
Yeah, regarding David Cameron in particular, I think off the back of what Seb said in particular, I sort of parallel that in thinking that he may well think what he thinks. I think it fits quite snugly, really, into the whole sort of rhetoric that appeals to the sort of the Sun and the Daily Mail readers about sort of fighting against the European Union. But as Luke's rightly pointed out, to be honest, it doesn't really matter a whole deal because nobody really knows a great deal about what's going on in that particular area. Most people are ignorant. And so even if David Cameron does think this, and even if it does fit snugly into his sort of whole rhetoric, it's not going to have a great big impact on the public as a whole.
It is a perennial problem, I think, in terms of Britain's relationship to Europe in general, not just the European Union, but also the Council of Europe. They're all very happy to sign up to all these obligations, but then when suddenly the boot's on the other foot and it's not in their interest, suddenly it's a breach of national sovereignty. But to bring it back to Juncker in particular, I think in this position, again, David Cameron is adopting a slightly oxymoronical position to take. He's coming back on it on the basis that this guy's a federalist, he's dangerous, he's going to stand in the way of proper EU reform, he's going to stop it from becoming more transparent, more democratic. But he's standing in the way of the European Parliament, and he's saying, well, actually, no, this cabal of 28 various ministers should be the ones to decide who runs the EC. It's a little bit counterfactual, in my opinion.
I mean, you mentioned your opinion that he was going to be under the thumb of the nation states. Could you explain why you think that?
Well, because the European Commission is the powerhouse of the European Union. Under the non-federated position we have at the moment, the European Parliament is still very, very vestigial. Any impact that it does have on the system is very, very diluted and is complexified by a Byzantine bureaucracy that's built up around the process of European legislation. Really, we're still in the position that the 28 member states send delegates from their various foreign ministries and foreign offices and basically decide amongst themselves, and then they pop it out to the European Parliament to make sure that it works out. And that's one of the reasons why I'm in favour of federalism. I think it would give us a lot more of a transparent, a lot better system in the European Union. At the moment, we're just trying to have our cake and eat it in terms of national sovereignty and the benefits of coming together, and I just don't think it's sustainable.
Luke?
I think the clear consensus on the panel is that there's not enough information about the European Union at the moment and about the candidates that are running for this position. And as far as the public's understanding of this goes, it is quite low. And that's something that I think the EU itself should be concerned with, because if we are talking about European Union, that's undoubtedly taken on more responsibilities, is getting involved in more areas, you know, is getting more competence in areas which originally it wasn't envisaged to do so, then it does need to have a greater legitimacy that simply can't be justified on the basis of, as we've said, 8.9% of Europeans, sorry, 8.3% of people across the whole EU not knowing the name of the candidate who could potentially be that commission president. And if the EU wants to make itself look more legitimate, then it's got to do its own work in trying to promote that. Although, again, in countries such as the UK, I know that that often gets shouted down. You know, if they do try and work through schools or something, it is called propaganda. And, you know, I remember when I was in year 10, I think we got a nice little diary that came through from the European Union, which did have their information everywhere. So I think it's got to get that right balance to appeal to people, or simply accept that perhaps it isn't as popular as it thinks it is, and there are certain things that it really shouldn't be doing after all.
Just a reminder, if you'd like to text me on this issue, the number to do so is 07762 212434, or you can send us a free web text. Seb?
Well, the issue of legitimacy is certainly key and interesting. I mean, perhaps in the future, to maximise legitimacy, there'd be a direct election for a European Commission president, but I fear even if that happened, then some would suggest that it would be happy, fear it would have more powers and therefore be a more powerful European Union. But under the current system, it seemed like the most democratic and legitimate way to do it is to have it sorted out through the European Parliament, and which grouping, you know, picking, as they picked in advance of the election, so the voters did know who would be each grouping's pick if they won the group. So that seems the most legitimate democratic way is to do it through the European Parliament rather than the cross-national negotiations with the Council of the Ministers.
David?
I think on top of that, you know, if we do step out of our own backyards for a moment and try and look at the European Union as a whole, and that's one of the things that the EC presidency is supposed to sort of encourage, is this kind of cross-border thinking about how different national politics feed into the European politics machine. On the one hand, I think they're going to be happy with the idea that they have the right to say who's in charge. On the other hand, I think the rise of right-wing populism and things like that, even if it didn't unseat the EPP as the plurality holder in the European Parliament, even if it didn't shake the status quo as much as perhaps was thought in the short term, I think there's going to be a lot of people out there who wouldn't be happy to see it pass from the Belgian Van Rompuy to the Luxembourgeois Juncker. I'll be honest, I just wanted to say the word Luxembourgeois. But in any event, the point remains, I think, that some of Cameron's concerns might be echoed across Europe. This isn't just, like I said at the start, Britain throwing its toys out of the pram because it wants special treatment. I think a lot of people who voted their protest votes into parties like Golden Dawn and, dare I say, UKIP, wouldn't be happy to see more of the same from the sorts of countries that have a very definite agenda within the European Federalist project.
Following our Voldemort moment, I mean, the European elections under the new rules have to be taken into account when deciding who the new president's going to be. The EU leaders traditionally choose the commission head on their own. So in light of the recent EU elections, does the EU need an established figure to make a better case for the EU? Or does it need a more reformist figure to make a better case for the EU, Luke?
Well, it at least needs an established way of selecting it. I mean, I'll be honest, I came into this debate very naively. And I'm, as I'm finding out more, I'm getting more and more shocked at the idea that we do have this institution with such power, you know, and with a power that is increasing, yet we still don't have a way of a uniform way of determining who's the head of it. You know, talk about taking the consideration of the direct vote, the only direct vote the public have in the EU, taking that into consideration when determining the commission. You know, I really think if the EU is got to address this this legitimacy crisis that exists at the minute, because I think if more and more people were to find out the truth about exactly how this happens at the minute, they would be appalled. I think they'd be right they'd be rightly appalled.
David. I do think Luke's got a lot of point there, actually. And again, that's one of the reasons why I support federalism, because we'd see a president who was actually directly elected. The thing about the European Union is that it sits unevenly between, on the one hand, the United States, and on the other hand, the United Nations, in terms of its political arrangement. No, regardless of the fact that that political arrangement has come out of what was originally an exclusively economic arrangement, there is an argument to say that it doesn't really know what it wants. It's bound up with all of the procedures of international law in general, which is very much dealt with by the states' parties and controlled by the nation states at the nation state level. But it also wants the kind of broad appeal of the United Nations, of something that is supposed to get beyond nation states and get beyond petty squabbles as well. And, you know, the United Nations is an abject failure to the extent that it's tried to do that. But nevertheless, the ambition is there. And I think it definitely needs a figure to come out of the woodwork and say, let's do this, let's take it forward, whether it's in the form of reformism, whether it's in the form of federalism. I think the politics of it don't matter. I think Luke is right. There needs to be an established position, and it needs to be clear how that person gets into power.
Farage, free you, Commission President. That was a joke. That was a joke. Please, everybody, I'm getting daggers across the room.
Everybody's faces in the rooms have suddenly just changed dramatically.
Cut his mic, better.
Seb, now, final point, Seb.
I think one thing you have to remember in the debate of whether you want a bit significant figure that's known in the European Commission or not is actually it is, I think, linked to in many people's minds, at least linked to the power that it has. And I think the concern that would happen, I think maybe from the right generally in Europe, would be that if you have a more significant, well-known figure, do they have more power? And at the same time, there's a lot of parties who are saying whenever the European Commission does things that are actually, no, it should be national sovereignty. And so therefore, from that side, it is the national sovereignty, national governments deciding it now, instead of it being the European Parliament and the European Commission. So while I think I would favour more direct election for a more established figure who has more legitimacy and is better known, I think moving towards that, you would still hear some people complain, whether fairly or not, it depends on whether they had more powers, that actually this was moving away from national sovereignty to a European super state, and so those fears would be voiced.
I do think, though, at the same time, you've got to remember the European Commission is very powerful, but the president is largely a figurehead. I mean, people basically elected appointed Van Rompuy on the basis that he was about 127 years old and wasn't really going to do anything.
He looks like a bank clerk as well, doesn't he? Oh, sorry, no, I've referenced UKIP again. I apologise.
Oh, dear. He's just, lots of Voldemort
moments. Just trolling it now, but... yeah, I think the position is still in a position where it has to calculate and it has to negotiate its own power base, and it's still in a very weak position at the moment. So, yeah, Cameron shouldn't throw his toys out of the cart too quickly.
Thank you for the you-know-who moments there. We'll be back talking about privatisation in the public sector after this.
This is URN.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Thank you for joining us. Next, we'll be discussing privatisation in the public sector and the future that it holds and the run-up to the next election. If you'd like to text in, the number to do so is 07762 212 434. We'll kick off by discussing the proposal by Michael Gove's Department for Education for some privatisation within child services. The professor... Eileen Munro, who Gove commissioned to carry out an independent review of child protection, published in 2011, has said that establishing a market in child protection would create perverse incentives for private companies to either take more children into care or leave too many languishing with dangerous families. So my question to the panel, should private services be introduced within the children's services, such a sensitive department, such a sensitive issue, David?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm a big opponent of privatisation in general. Sometimes it can have qualified successes, and sometimes, frankly, it just needs to happen if the government is in bad enough economic straits. But particularly in an area like child services, you want to keep the profit motive out of it. And I think the message that we're learning, particularly from prison privatisation at the moment, which was very much the champion of the payment by results approach, and also by the abject failure of the work programme, which is the precursor to probation privatisation, which we'll probably talk a little bit about later on in the debate. I think we can see that it's just too difficult to control the profit motive in this situation. Standards are going to get slashed. People are going to suffer. People are going to lose out. And all the while, the companies are too big to fail for the government to ever realistically do anything about it. So I think it's a dreadful idea, and I would rue the day that it happens.
Seb?
Yeah, I'd agree. I'm less of across the border opponent to privatisation. I think it can be good in some circumstances, can be in bad. I mean, that's probably the same as David. Perhaps you have maybe some I'd be more in favour of than David. But I think it doesn't take a genius, even someone who isn't, anyone who isn't massively ideologically in favour of privatisation in almost all circumstances, suggests this was even intuitively one of the worst places to start with child services. Because clearly the only motive you want in this case is what's best for the child. And if there is a payments by results, really, it's hard to tell what results are. I mean, in terms of foster care, it's much longer term and harder to discern what a successful result is. And clearly in a complicated and sensitive area such as this, I think privatisation is wrong and misguided.
Luke, Seb has said it doesn't take a genius. What do you say to
good,
that?
Good. Well, thanks, Seb. That sets me up quite nicely then to make at least some kind of comment on this. I come from the opposite idea to David, which is a more supportive of privatisation overall in the way that Michael Fallon, who's sort of become the privatisation minister, really, in biz. He was overseeing the successful privatisation of Royal Mail, and he's also overseeing the land registry side of things. Basically, he looks at, and he's previously said in Parliament, that his perspective is that those services which have no overwhelming case to be done in the public sphere should be at least considered whether or not they could survive more successfully in the private sector. And I agree that that's very often the case. And something like the land registry, which is also next on the list kind of thing for privatisation, is an absolute example of how certain services do not need to be in the hands of the state and can be done perfectly effectively outside of it. There is clearly a distinction between something like that, which would be the service delivery side of the land registry, and something as sensitive as child protection, something that is as important as child protection. You know, I would probably say that child protection services do a role that is a lot more sensitive than the land registry. I think that's probably a fairly uncontroversial statement to make. But even so, I think we can't over-exaggerate the consequences of putting it in private hands. You know, we're not talking about letting the private actors completely decide what they do in these circumstances. The law, as set down by Parliament, our elected representatives will still apply. You know, they're still going to have to act in accordance with the Children Act that governs child protection and child law much more generally. And they're not going to be allowed to breach that. And obviously there are requirements in there that they put the child's interests first. As far as the actual service delivery side of things go, I mean, the case for privatisation is that you're going to get a little bit more innovation in there. You are going to get the sort of opportunities that you don't see in a strictly public sector sphere. But, you know, I'll confess I'm not a genius, and clearly it's not one area that you would immediately look at and think maybe this is the right place to privatise it. But I think at the same time, we can't exaggerate the consequences of doing so, and we have to leave open the option that at the minute we're getting a little bit lax sometimes in the way that we're doing child protection, and maybe if it was in private hands, it could be a little bit more innovation there.
Joe?
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with Luke on that. But then again, I would also want to point out that we can't really dichotomise in this debate. There's this sort of, you know, nationalisation versus privatisation debate that continues in this country. I think really the issue with privatisation is that it's got to work where it works, you know, if that makes sense. It's got to be implemented where it works. I think I agree broadly with David, although I don't uphold his sort of strong nationalisation agenda, if you can call it that.
You can call it that, it's fine.
I'll call it that. But I think in child services, I think it can be, or it looks to be, quite sort of perverse in a sense, because it does seem to be profit over people. And despite what Luke said, I think you'll have a problem upholding that to a certain extent. If I can take a sort of personal example of my family, and my brother's disabled, and in his case, sort of getting to school and what have you, privatisation of some services does work with some of them. In some of the ones, it doesn't. So taxi services, for example, they've changed about sort of three times. And in his case, where he needs consistency because of his condition, you know, that can be a problem. Fortunately, it's all worked out. In other cases, it works absolutely fine. I think we can't have this sort of binary view of nationalisation versus privatisation. And in all cases, people need to make sure, i.e. elected representatives need to make sure, that they have a firm grasp over the profit motive and that companies don't get ahead of themselves.
I think we do need to recognise to a certain extent the trigger happiness of the current coalition government. And, you know, this is something I watched with a sort of sense of perverse pleasure this morning when I watched the Lib Dem Twitter hounds getting on around the Queen's speech and saying, the Lib Dems did this, this is a Lib Dem policy, don't you like the Lib Dems, ahead of 2015 and after their drubbing in the European elections. It was very embarrassing. The point is, privatisation is on their hands as well. Across a wide variety of things that have been put into the private sector since 2010. And I think the scale has ramped up a lot, and we've seen a lot of very public failures that have just been excused. Even when there wasn't what Luke was describing, that when there wasn't a clear profit motive to screw up, where there wasn't, you know, if you put a private company in charge of the land registry, I agree with Luke, you probably would have a legal regime set up around it so that they couldn't then exploit their control over the sale of land in such a way as to turn a better profit for themselves and to exploit their own interests and their own stock. But even in that situation, you have companies like Atos, you have companies like G4S and Serco that have just failed again and again and again because they drive down standards, they drive down costs, not to provide the best service, to provide the most minimum standard service available. And when it goes wrong, it goes really wrong.
Luke?
Well, I think, because the debate has focused specifically on the child protection issues, you know, we do need to take a look at exactly what is being proposed here. And very often we come at these sort of debates with a very broad brush, and we say, yeah, privatisation, that's obviously terrible. You know, the duties that are carried out by local authorities, no one's suggesting they'll all be completely handed over. I think what it is about is it's improving innovation. And I mean, the profit motive, which has obviously formed part of the major opposition so far, we're probably going to be talking about charities here that are going to be doing this part of this thing as well. And particularly within child protection already, groups like the NSPCC do an incredible job, which at the minute they're not able to do to the full extent because the powers are there to mean that everything is done by the local authorities at the moment. If you allowed some kind of system, and again, I would emphasise, I don't think the government, and they've reassured people on several occasions that they don't intend to completely come at this and say, yeah, let's hand this all over into private hands. It's more about allowing certain services that might benefit from the innovation that the private sector, rather, is able to provide. And I think, you know, before we do discuss this in such detail, we do need to have a look at exactly what the proposals are, because it's a lot more specific and detailed than I think we've come at this debate thinking.
Seb?
Firstly, on the quick point about David and the Lib Dems saying this in the Queen's speech. That's, and that refers to a more broader point in a problem with third parties, particularly in a coalition, needing a distinctiveness and show that you. And there is a problem across coalitions, generally with small parties. I think Lib Dems have been afflicted with, which is getting the blame but not necessarily getting the credit, and having to convince people that you didn't sell out and actually we are having an influence in coalition. So that's part of that. But I agree, it can, to those who are more politically focused, who are aware of kind of distinctions in party, look like they're shouting very loudly to be heard. Back on the kind of more relevant point, I suppose, to child services, an odd point Luke said several times, and many in favour of privatisation do always say about bringing innovation, but certainly in the case of child protection, I find it hard to imagine what is bringing innovation to child protection. It seems like a pro kind of privatisation buzzword, which, you know, in certain fields is very true. Privatisation can increase innovation, but I'm not entirely sure what that does look like in child protection services.
Joe?
Yeah, I won't rebuttal Seb regarding the Lib Dem thing. It'll just drive me mad in the end. But my overarching point, well, the specific point at first is that, you know, in this case, I don't think privatisation should be initiated at all. I think it's quite perverse, really. I think the overarching theme is that you can't be sort of dogmatic about it, really, and it has to work, you know, in the correct circumstances. I think that's really the point to take away from this.
There's David. A point, well, there's a number of points I could come back on, but Luke makes a very good point, I think, about the role of the what's called the voluntary and community sector. I have a big problem with the concept of the community, because my thesis is in the field of community punishment, probation, that sort of thing, and that's a term that gets bandied around quite a lot. Not so much, well, not as much as you might think in the context of the probation privatisation system. But the fact is that, you know, I think Joe raised a good point earlier that we don't just have nationalisation and privatisation. We have this idea of contestation, of, you know, opening up the market to private, public and voluntary firms to work in sort of competition with one another. You also have more entrenched cooperation, more sort of enforced grassroots participation. And I think that's what people really want to see out of these sorts of privatisation. The sort of thing that Luke's talking about is getting the community carer, the voluntary care worker, into the child protection game. I nearly said racket, but a protection racket's a different thing. In any event, it's about engaging the community. The problem is, again, the scale of privatization that the coalition is engaged in has often been to scale up rather than scale down, to make it more national rather than making it more communal, to make it more about locality rather than the human element. And often the voluntary and community sector gets frozen out of that, and it falls back into the hands of Atos, G4S, Serco. Maybe not so much in child protection if it does go forwards, but I would say that's the norm rather than the exception.
The Green Party has made the case for renationalising the railways. What do we think about that? Should they be? Should parts of it be renationalised, or should all of it be renationalised? Well, Luke, what are your thoughts?
These are questions that we're coming at it, and obviously in certain fields, David does have a specialism, because he is what might be considered for any radio show, not only student radio show. This is a compliment for you, David, by the way. So, but he has an element of expertise that we as mere undergraduates do lack.
It's true.
And I think we can probably all agree on something like the National Rail. None of us are that expert in it, even David?
Not so much.
But and I think when we do approach it, you know, we are playing into that kind of privatisation versus nationalisation. Look, when we say, right, should we renationalise the railway? Well, none of us really know the full effects of doing so. If there is a strong case that says renationalising the railway is going to make a major improvement in terms of savings for consumers, in terms of savings for the state, in terms of general savings and improvement of services, then, you know, that there shouldn't be a fundamental reason why you shouldn't renationalise or privatise an industry. You know, that's not the thing that you should be motivated by in all these decisions, is by an improvement in service, and in particular in the public sector, looking at whether or not it's going to be an increased cost burden, or whether
I mean,
or not
the
it's
reason I bring this up
money.
Is the reason I bring this up is because of the high prices that consumers have been feeling, and whether the renationalisation might bring down prices in some respect.
Well, you can pass it on through taxation, or you can have it through. You know, it isn't a case of cost is going to simply go down and disappear as a result of renationalising the railway.
Okay, that's Luke's opinion.
There's
David.
A certain element. There's a certain statistical element that suggests that that's not the case. I mean, we have seen since the railways were denationalised in the 1990s. I think the figures suggest a 250% maximum rise in prices, and a massive increase as well in the amount of government subsidies that go to the private firms, that go to network routes, now somewhere in the region of £4 billion, which isn't as much as it sounds like, but which is still, you know, a lot of hospital beds. But I think the only point I'd make there about the Greens, about Sadiq Khan saying that he'd reverse the probation privatisation Is that it's not that simple to put the genie back in the bottle. It's not always a costless activity. And in that regard, you have to take that with a pinch of salt. I say it's a good idea, but you have to be long-termist about it.
Okay, Joe.
Yeah, I am, again, following up from Luke, really, I don't know really where I stand on this. You know, you can also dichotomize by country. Germany, nationalization works very well. Japan, privatization works very well. So really, it's a difficult case. I mean, in this country, I think it's part of... Someone correct me if I'm wrong. It's part of the East Coast that is nationalised, and that works very well, and they've got low costs. But then again, I've got a certain wariness of nationalisation in the railways in any case. So really, I think it's a tricky one. But again, harking back to our sort of previous conversation regarding nationalisation versus privatisation almost, it really depends on what works for people. And I think the government's got to sort of take that step to find out, essentially. And we mustn't deal in just sort of binary debate.
Seb?
Well, I firstly, on the point about us being experts or not, I'd say that I don't think that's ever stopped political pundits before. So I don't think we're alone in that. But it's a case, and none of us know it in detail, so we'd have to be a more detailed analysis to actually be certain. But I say one of the problems why privatisation may not have been so effective in the railways is that they are natural monopolies, therefore the competition isn't so good. So if after research said that fares would be low and that the overall cost to consumers and would be lower under nationalisation, then yes, it would suggest that that may be more effective.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much from the panel for coming in. I just had to say a big thank you to all of you for coming this past year and the year before.
And can I just say, actually, Matt, thank you as well, because this is your last time.
Thank you, yes.
I've known you for a long time on this show. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know we're running out of time, and I'd love to go on about how fabulous you are for a long time.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Best of luck going forward.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. It's been a fantastic time here at URN. I really appreciate it. I will miss it very much. And a special thanks to David for all of his help over the years. He's been incredibly helpful producing, organising, and being a panellist as well, and a host. So thank you all very much. Best of luck. We'll leave you with some Elbow. Have a great week and good luck with exams. Have a great summer.